Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us.
The 2020 legislative session starts in just a few months. This session will create the state budget for the next couple of years. And there will be a 900-pound values gorilla in the room. And no, we're not talking about the state employees' pension. We're talking about Kentucky's cuts in funding for education, some of the worst cuts in the nation. Will legislators act to reverse that trend, or will they make decisions that make it even worse? Joining us for a look at what's at stake is Ashley Spaulding, a senior policy analyst at the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. Thanks for coming in, Ashley.
Thanks for having me.
There was a headline in a recent edition of the Northern Kentucky Tribune, and it put it this way: Kentucky public schools see decline in per-student funding, must make up difference locally or cut programs. The article was based on your analysis. Is that an accurate description of where we are right now?
Yes, I would say that it is. You know, when the state doesn't adequately fund the SEEK formula, which is the funding formula where our school districts get the majority of their funding, when the state doesn't provide adequate funding, then it falls on our local districts to either make up the difference or to make cuts or to do a combination of those. And that's what we see happening across the state.
And the state is not adequately funding SEEK. And how long has that been going on?
That's right. Well, in terms of what is truly adequate, that's a much bigger question. The Council on Better Education released a report in 2014 that said that really to provide truly adequate funding for our state to be able to, you know, have the best practices for education in our state, that we would need to invest an additional $2.4 billion. However, in terms of measuring it, as we often do, going back to before the Great Recession, we have been cutting education funding, cutting per-student education funding in SEEK since after the Great Recession. And a lot of states did that. But states that have had such deep funding cuts since the recession like we have begun reinvesting. A lot of them have, and we have not. We have continued to cut.
Many local communities in the Coalfields region in particular have experienced a decline in such revenue sources as coal severance funds. The tax base has eroded, and so they're already stressed. Is it likely that they're going to have to make cuts?
Well, we know our organization, the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy, we surveyed school districts 2 years ago and asked them about what the impact of funding cuts and funding freezes had been between 2008 and 2017. And we learned that districts are already making cuts. They're making cuts to their course offerings. They're cutting the number of instructional days. They're cutting after school staff. There are school districts are already making these cuts. And so the more this goes on, the more cuts that will have to be made.
Okay. And that study a couple of years ago produced this spreadsheet of the districts that details how these cuts have hit various communities. And since we have such limited time now, I'm going to post that document on the facts and information page of our site, esweku.com. And you can go there to read it or download it if you like. Back in 1989, the Kentucky Supreme Court declared the state school funding system unconstitutional. And the ruling forced lawmakers to reimagine how Kentucky would pay for its schools by mandating that they reduce disparities between rich and poor districts. And so the legislators quickly passed legislation that amounted to a complete overhaul of the K through 12 system. And by the mid-90s, it was really paying off. Reading and math scores were up. More students were graduating and going on to college. A lot more were, actually. So this was a godsend to many in eastern Kentucky, where education is akin to an escape plan from poverty. Is Kentucky still in compliance with that ruling?
I think it's questionable. I think it's very possible that we are not. The Roe decision happened in 1989, and so that we're at the 30th anniversary here. And then in 1990, the Kentucky Education Reform Act was passed. And so when we look at, you know, one of the primary tenets of the Roe decision was that the General Assembly must provide equal educational opportunities to all Kentucky children. And when we look at the these issues of the pressures put on local communities to make up for state funding cuts, you know, poorer school districts aren't as able to raise the revenue needed as wealthier school districts. And so in addition to, or as part of all the educational gains that you mentioned, you know, with CARA and with the funding through the SEEK formula, we saw a decline in the funding gap between Kentucky's poorest and wealthiest school districts when CARA went into effect. But over time, as SEEK has been inadequately funded, we've seen that this gap continue to grow. And our organization, you know, every year we update our analysis of where the funding gap is now. And we're actually getting very close to pre-CARA levels. Here at the 30th anniversary of the Roe decision, we have a growing amount of inequity in these per pupil funding gap between Kentucky's poorest and wealthiest districts.
Wow. So we're almost back to before square A, back before that Supreme Court ruling.
That's right. That's right. And the SEEK formula was created in order to provide the equitable funding. The SEEK formula distributes funding to make up for these wealth differences. But when you don't adequately fund the formula, its ability to provide equitable funding is compromised.
So I've read that this gap that we're talking about, it persists at least in part because one thing that the legislators failed to do was to deal with a fundamental imbalance that comes from relying on local property taxes. Is that accurate?
Well, the over-reliance on property taxes is created by the underfunding of SEEK.
And some legislators talking about SEEK, which is the core school funding per pupil base guarantee that we have, that's an outgrowth of that court ruling. They say that Kentucky's current education funding levels have never been higher. But in your analysis, you say that what is actually historic here is the depth of state funding cuts. Well, it can't be both. Can you explain?
Sure. So the SEEK per pupil guarantee is the amount that every district is guaranteed. So that's established as part of the SEEK formula, and that's part of the state budget. So in the last budget that was passed, the SEEK per pupil guarantee was established at $4,000 per student. And it is true that $4,000 is the highest that the base per pupil guarantee has been. However, the $4,000, the base per pupil guarantee, is a combination of state and local funding. And so what we see is that the state portion has been declining. So since 2008, the state portion has declined $122. And the local portion has increased by $300. So we cannot say that this is a historic level of state investment in education, in the per pupil guarantee even specifically. And then when you adjust for inflation, that's another point that, that people bring up. Even when you look at the state and local dollars together with that $4,000, when you adjust for inflation, that's a 22% cut since 2008. And then, of course, we also have to look at other parts of the education budget. There's no funding for textbooks. There's no funding for professional development. We've seen cuts to our extended school services, which are our after-school programs that are especially so critical for students from low-income households. And even the additional investment in Friskies, the Family Resource and Youth Services Centers that also provide supports for low-income students and their families. The additional investment in Friskies, when you adjust for inflation, that also is a cut. So there are a lot of concerning cuts in education. So these are historic cuts. It doesn't take much to calculate the difference between some funding for textbooks and zero funding for textbooks. That's 100% cut. I also do want to mention that another important part of looking at the funding cuts and understanding the increased pressure on local funds, looking at transportation in the budget. And transportation, obviously, our kids need to get to school. And by statute, the state must pay 100% of the estimated transportation funds, the qualifying costs for transportation for school districts. However, since the early 2000s, the state has not been doing that. In our current situation, we see that in 2019, transportation is funded at just 66%. So when we don't fund transportation adequately, when we cut the per pupil guarantee, the state portion, these cuts are all putting pressure on local school districts to make up the difference. And the local districts are raising revenue to try to make up these differences. But again, the poorer school districts are very disadvantaged in doing so. And at the same time, we're seeing the impacts of these cuts harming kids in classrooms across the state.
I want to get to that, but I want to get back to something you just said that really caught my ear. That 100% funding is mandated by statute.
That's right.
So again, the state is out of compliance.
That's right. With state law, a lot of people talk about, you know, the term notwithstanding. So, you know, the constitutional case, I think, is a different one than sort of not complying with the statute in this way, because there are a number of ways that the state budget doesn't withstand the really what has been set out. But that is correct, that it is in statute that the state pay 100% of the transportation.
In your analysis, you make the argument that these cuts are doing very real harm to our children, not in theory, but in reality. Can you elaborate?
Yes. And this is where, as these cuts have been happening, at times, lawmakers don't seem as concerned as they should about what the impacts have been. And that led us to do a survey of school districts, of all the school districts, 173 in 2017. It led us to survey these districts and ask them, among other things, what has been the greatest impact of cuts and funding freezes since 2008, between 2008 and 2017. And we asked a lot of very specific questions, and then we asked that broader question, what the greatest impact of cuts have been. And I just want to give a few statistics from our sample.
Sure.
54% of surveyed districts had fewer days in the school calendar as a result of these cuts and freezes. 35% had reduced or eliminated art and music programs. 30% had special course offerings funded by the district in 2008 that were no longer funded. In 2017, 25% had reduced or eliminated career and technical education. And we see districts, you know, as part of trying to raise funds locally, 35% had begun implementing or increased instructional fees. 34% had begun implementing or increased fees for extracurricular activities, you know, to try to make up for some of these cuts. And then we see 42% had reduced student support, such as after school, summer school, and intervention or enrichment services. They're spending less on health services, many school districts. And 14% had reduced special education services for reasons related to cost. So, you know, districts talked about having to reduce staff, being unable to give needed raises, lack of funding for materials such as textbooks. And at the time of that survey, there was some funding for textbooks and instructional materials. So imagine where we are now. This was 2 years ago, and the situation has only gotten worse in terms of funding.
Well, I'm sitting here stunned because I've never heard it put together in aggregate like that. And it is really disturbing. You conclude your analysis by noting that the crafting a better state budget in 2020, or even one that simply maintains the status quo, stays at current levels of underfunding, will be difficult. Why is that?
That's right. Well, the revenue picture is not looking good. Revenue, it's not great. And then in the past couple of years, the state legislature has passed special interest tax breaks that, you know, reduce our ability to make critical investments in education. And so in order to move our education funding in the right direction, we're going to need additional revenue. It's a very difficult budget. And we need to do that by clawing back some of these tax giveaways to very wealthy individuals and corporations. And we just passed more tax breaks last session, getting rid of the bank franchise tax. So we gave $56 million to banks last year when we're in this situation with our education funding.
Ashley Spaulding is a senior policy analyst at the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. Thanks so much, Ashley.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up after the break, the refugee experience in Lexington, an archaeologist who finds clues to the past in the most unusual places, and later in the hour, a famed journalist's plea.
There is no democracy without journalism.
Stay with us. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It could be used in a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
The word and the very meaning of refugee has become charged in today's political environment. How is all of the rhetoric, the debate, and the policy change playing out among refugees who have made new homes in central Kentucky? To find out, we're talking with Derek Feldman. He's Community Engagement Coordinator at the Lexington branch of Kentucky Refugees Ministries. Thanks for coming in, Derek.
Thank you so much for having me.
And let me begin with the question that I just posed in the introduction. How, in today's political environment, with all of this rhetoric, the debate, all the policy change that's going on, how's that affecting life among refugees who've made new homes in central Kentucky?
There's lots going on, lots of different things coming at them all at once. First is just the new experience of being here in a new country, in a new city, perhaps with a new language. Very often, a culture. And so just that in and of itself is just a difficult thing to do, to go through. Lexington tends to, in my opinion, tends to be very welcoming. But we hear a lot in the news and the rhetoric that's going around that people, I think, you know, can be demonized. They can suggest things like immigrants and refugees here are somehow a drain on society and things like that. So that filters into, you know, the overall narrative.
Are you encountering some people, a lot of people who are arriving here knowing about all that and perhaps worried about how they might be received?
Again, both. I think they recognize that coming here to the United States offers a chance at a new life and an amazing opportunity to restart and to continue their life in a new way. But certainly there are significant fears and concerns about whether or not they will be welcomed. There's, you know, people talk amongst themselves once they're here, they're hearing on the news and that kind of thing. So it's, again, it's a mixed bag. It's, of course, this is an amazing opportunity, and they are well aware of that. And then also the general feeling sometimes that, you know, are we really welcome here? Do we really belong here?
There is an awful lot of sound and fury out there and a lot of debate, but it seems to me that in the midst of all that, the humanity of what we're talking about gets lost. And we're talking about human beings here, people like you and me, people with loves and aspirations. We have tens of thousands of unfilled jobs in this country, and they're screaming for skilled, intelligent, creative people to fill them. What are some examples of how refugees who've come to America and come to the Lexington community, how they have contributed to the local economy and culture?
Primarily, people are coming here and are looking for a second chance, looking for a new start to their life. When new arrivals come, they get that support, and then they're expected to become self-sufficient within that first year after arrival. That can be difficult, but with the need that's out there, you know, employers are looking for good employees. And so usually, actually, most of our clients get a job within the first 6 months of arrival and work towards being self-sufficient for themselves, you know, and their family. And employers come to us. We work with lots of employers here in the Central Kentucky area who need employees, and they get hardworking, dedicated, reliable employees. So much so, for example, Toyota wants to work with and has had good experiences with our clients that they created a shuttle service, essentially, to come to Lexington to pick up people to take them to Georgetown.
Is there a tendency to enclave, to create cloistered areas of people because there's a sense of security in knowing others who speak your language and understand your culture?
Yeah. So when a refugee is in a refugee camp and under the protection of the United Nations High Commission on Refugees, and then has applied for resettlement either in the United States or UK or Germany, and they go through lots of screening processes and everything, but eventually the State Department essentially handpicks people to be resettled in the United States. When they do that, they, you know, 99.9% of the time they have a U.S. tie. So it's a family member, it's a brother, sister, a cousin, mom that's already here. And so they're offered, you know, resettlement in a place where they already have a U.S. tie. Now, obviously, there's always kind of the first of that group maybe to arrive. Also, once they arrive in the United States, it's a free country. So they may arrive in South Dakota but have other family members here in Lexington. So they end up coming to Lexington. And then that starts another kind of group. So, yeah, that's why there's kind of a critical mass of, for example, in Lexington recently, the Democratic Republic of the Congo is the largest population of refugees that KRM serves, as well as Ukrainians right now.
The Trump administration has set a refugee ceiling for 2020 of 18,000. I believe that's the lowest ever in U.S. history.
Correct.
Your thoughts on the impact of that?
That's really important, and I want to take just a step back just for a second.
Sure.
This has been a Democrat and Republican point of agreement for the encouragement of refugee resettlement, the importance, the humanitarian and eventual economic impact here in the United States of why this is important. Throughout, Carter, Reagan, George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, Clinton, Obama, this has always been a point of agreement, up usually around the 100,000 refugee ceiling.
So from 100,000 to 18,000.
Yes.
Okay.
Even after, for example, I point out, even after September 11th, where you would understandably see a heightened sense of security and pause, that was still at 70,000 at that time for all of the George W. Bush presidency, up at 70,000. And so for it to be, since this current administration, it's gone from 45,000 to 30,000 to now 18,000.
And there is an executive order that accompanies that ceiling, correct? And what's that about?
Correct. That's a new thing that has happened. The executive order, in theory, allows states and cities to opt out of resettlement completely. That's never been done in the United States. It's still unclear exactly how that's going to be implemented. Because of it, there is a 90-day hold while the State Department explains to people exactly what does that mean. Is that a letter from the mayor, from the governor? Is the default that you automatically opt in and you have to opt out? Is it the opposite? We don't know. So in that process right now, there's a 90-day hold. And so the entire resettlement system here in the United States is on hold. And specifically, Kentucky is interesting because our governor election is going to happen within that 90 days. So that will have an extremely interesting impact on what goes forward.
Talking about some specific cases that I know you're aware of, I understand that these include some of the people who had flights canceled. Tell us about this and how that impacted those people.
Yeah. So like you said, these are, you know, real people. We hear numbers, 18,000, 100,000, but these are actual human beings who have family and friends and close relatives, people that they care about and love, who are in a refugee camp. And they're here waiting. These are, for example, there's a father who lives here in Lexington, and he is waiting for his wife and child. People are waiting here, and they've gone through an extensive process, this application process to be resettled. It starts at least 2 years and can take 20 years to get through the entire process. When they've gone through each step and then finally get to the point where they've booked flight to the U.S., there's a very small window. It's about 3 months where they need to fly during that time. If they're unable to fly during that time, they go back to the beginning. Wow. All over again. So it's not simply a matter of, well, it's on hold right now. So, oh, okay, well, in a couple of months when we get it all figured out, they'll just come. They may have missed that window completely. And so now being able to see their family member may take years, maybe never.
You touched on this earlier, and I'd like to wrap up our conversation by asking you again, how do you describe the overall reception or welcoming atmosphere in Lexington?
In my job as community engagement coordinator, I get to speak with lots of groups. I speak with church groups and community organizations and schools and classrooms and teachers and all kinds of different people. Oftentimes, I'm preaching to the choir. When I talk about what we do, people are, you know, enthusiastic and want to talk about how they can help, how they can advocate for refugees. So I see the welcome spirit of Lexington a lot. In my, you know, the circles that I swim in, again, I see a very welcoming Lexington. I know for a fact that there are people who are not welcoming. That's clear, I think, in what we hear in the rhetoric and things. You know, for example, we're Kentucky Refugee Ministries, but most of our signs are just KRM because honestly, we've had threats against us or against, you know, the work that we do or against our clients. So we have to have things like, you know, active shooter drills and things like that in place. It's a sad state of affair that certainly is there. But like I said, the overall experiences that we experience is a very welcoming Lexington. And when we ask our clients, how are you getting along here in Lexington? What, you know, do you feel welcome here? Do the people smile and greet you and that kind of thing? Overwhelmingly, they say, yes, we feel very welcome here.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
Derek Feldman, Community Engagement Coordinator at the Lexington branch of Kentucky Refugee Ministries. And thank you so much, Derek.
Thank you so much for having me.
I saw her on the fences through all the borders. She's been a lot of places, sharks in the water. I only want her with me, bring on the trouble. Some never see her beauty. No, I see the struggle. I'm a refugee. Come around here, come around here. You're a refugee from around there, from around there.
The Kentucky Historical Society's Stephanie Lang makes her Eastern Standard interviewing debut talking trash in a very interesting and scholarly way.
Welcome to Dr. Zeta Kimura from the University of Kentucky. She is an interdisciplinary and social science professor at the University of Kentucky's Lewis Honor College. She is a historical archaeologist whose research focuses on destabilizing persistent stereotypes about Appalachia through the material culture of the 20th century to the recent past. Her work has focused on gender, race, and class at company-owned coal mining towns in eastern Kentucky, and she administers the UK Appalachian Center's wonderful Coal Camp documentary project. Welcome, Zeta.
Thank you, Stephanie.
So I'm curious, how did you become involved in Appalachian historical archaeology?
That's a good question. People always like to ask archaeologists about our origin story. I think they're expecting something glamorous that has to do with Egypt. Actually, I grew up in an Appalachian community in rural northwestern Pennsylvania, very rural. We were pretty poor when I was younger, and one of the things my brother and I like to do is dig in the trash bin under my parents' house, which is pretty old, a couple hundred years old, and we would dig up the toys of other children that had come before us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe that's my origin story, but I think it's really because I was always aware of my status as an other in my own community because of material culture. We get very upset in rural Appalachia when somebody calls us a hillbilly, but it's a word that we leverage against each other in any kind of local dispute. And, you know, I remember being at school and getting made fun of. I wore my cousin's hand-me-down clothing and just, you know, everything about, you know, my material self told other people that I didn't belong. And when I say material culture, I mean, you know, we think about artifacts and archaeology, so objects made and modified by human beings. But material culture goes a step beyond to think about how they act in our social world, how we shape materials as they shape us. I decided in college that I liked archaeology well enough to go to grad school for it. Anthropology became my home. That's where kind of all the social deviants go that don't fit in. I always joke that anthropologists become anthropologists because we all want to answer that question. Why don't I fit in? And I had been working on a service project in Lee County, Kentucky, that my aunt runs since I was 15. And the first time I went to Lee County, I thought, I'm home. This is it. This is like where I grew up, but a little bit different. And I originally thought I wanted to go somewhere totally new for grad school and do something glamorous. I got into the University of Hawaii, but I realized that I needed to study home, if not the Appalachian county where I grew up, then one that felt like home, sort of combat that brain drain. And I, you know, I always knew that all these stereotypes about people like me and my communities, my friends and family and neighbors all over Appalachia were very firmly entangled with material culture. And I thought, why aren't scholars largely making this connection? And so I thought, well, I guess it's my job to do this. I don't know, you know, no one studies social dynamics involving material culture like archaeologists. And so, you know, while the public often thinks of us as these historian heroes studying glamorous things like Indiana Jones or Egyptologists they see on TV, that's not me. If you want to know about, say, how, you know, a lowly ketchup bottle recovered from a coal town in eastern Kentucky, like how that's entangled in the politics of gender and representation, like, I'm your gal. So, you know, I thought, ultimately, how can I change the world for people that I care about? Because representation of Appalachia affects policy and our treatment of others, you know? So I really want to help see Appalachia differently, and I think archaeology can do that.
It's one of the best things, I think, about Appalachian studies as a whole. My background is history, but, you know, the interdisciplinary research that you bring to it really gives a more nuanced and ways for us to really dig in and look at the history of it. You know, so often, particularly in the national narrative now, a lot of that history seems to be and conversations seem to be co-opted. So, you know, your look at company towns, they've been discussed widely mm-hmm. in the formation of, you know, some of the Appalachian stereotypes that we think about today. But why study those towns in the way that you are doing as opposed to perhaps, you know, my being in an archive and why right. did you settle in on Jenkins?
Yeah, that's a great question. Jenkins is a remarkable place. So I did my dissertation research in Jenkins in Letcher County, Kentucky, that and its sister town, McRoberts, which were built by the Consolidation Coal Company in 1911 and operated into the 40s by Consol. And for a few reasons, there was an archaeological study done there in the 1990s in advance of a surface mining permit in a place called Shop Hollow, and it was a 20th century dump site. And they heavily excavated it because the mining subsequently destroyed the site. It's no longer accessible. It's gone on the landscape. And I thought, you know, I don't want to start cold. I want to build on previous research. And one of my mentors and committee members, Kim McBride, an excellent archaeologist, was at UK, and she had worked on this project. And it has a weird history. It was the principal investigator sadly died, and it got relegated to an equipment cage in the Kentucky Archaeological Survey. And I thought, what can I do with this huge orphaned collection? One of the biggest recovered from a coal, the biggest recovered from a coal town in Kentucky. And I thought, well, I guess I have to work in Jenkins. And I looked at it and I thought, you know, Jenkins is a model town that presents benefits, you know, and it presents opportunity. Let's say it presents opportunities. Model towns were characterized by a high degree of corporate paternalism and welfare capitalism, you know, providing everything wonderful for the worker to keep them from unionizing, which, you know, obviously there are negative elements to that, of course. But one thing Model Town is good for is archival generation. There was a really strong archival presence. For example, a collection of almost 4,000 glass plate negatives that went to the Smithsonian because they were so, you know, the Consol was so impressed with its flagship town, they photographed it from 1911 into the 40s, you know, the grand social experiment. And I started to memorize those pictures. I started to enter the town through an archival sense, and then I entered it physically. I went to Jenkins for the first time in 2012 when they were planning their centennial and met folks on the centennial committee. And it was amazing. It was like living in the present and the past, where what I would see on the landscape flickered between the black and white that I had memorized in the photos and what I saw before me. And I would see buildings come and go and fade in and out. And as, you know, like my map memory from above started to link with my local memory, I realized it was still an amazing place. And I was very heavily welcomed by local folks. And I was worried about it. You know, I'm an outsider to that community, even though we have a lot in common being from rural Appalachia and post-industrial Appalachia. But people were really interested in helping me simply because I wanted to know. And they were interested in meeting someone who didn't already have a negative opinion of their town and their lifestyle and their culture, them as people. And I thought, you know, I think it is important to study something like a model town because it's an outlier. If company coal towns range on a spectrum, as many historians like Ron Eller have suggested, model towns are obviously on the high end. And, you know, seasonal camps, for example, very hastily built, no corporate paternalism, those would be on the other end. And I really wanted to explore narratives about homogeneity. There's, you know, the idea that coal towns were all the same, including their people. And I thought, you know, for a dissertation, the small seasonal ones would have been logistically challenging. And you also got to be reasonable. I thought that can be my life's work. Archaeology will be relevant there because that really may be the only thing left of some of these communities that no longer exist in public memory and don't exist in the archive. But you also have to get a PhD. So I went with the town that had the stuff, honestly.
So you had mentioned a little bit about some of the coal towns that no longer exist, and it automatically makes me think of the Coal Camp Documentary Project, which is a wonderful project that the UK Appalachian Center works on. And they are documenting all of these places, countless mm-hmm. places that are – you can still go to Jenkins, but there are others that the footprint is no longer there.
Right.
So tell me a little bit more about that project and why it's important.
So the Coal Camp Project was a collaborative documentary history project, meaning crowdsourced data, and we were really excited to do that. Unfortunately, the Appalachian Center has been descaled in terms of staff, and now I just volunteer my time on the project. But, you know, if you're out there and you live in a coal town and you say have a reunion and you want somebody to come do oral history, like, get on our website and give me a holler because, you know, history shouldn't just be written by us scholars. It should be written by folks who live there. And we want to help facilitate that.
So in your research, I'm curious to know a little bit more about some of the material culture, because in mm-hmm. some different conferences that we've been to in the past, you've talked about things like the ketchup bottle, things like the plates from the Sears Roebuck catalog, and showing that this part of Eastern Kentucky wasn't some isolated backward. Why is studying everyday goods important? And, you know, what do they tell us? What's something different that they tell us about the way we think about the history of the coal camps?
Yeah, what a great question, because it's not a data source that most disciplines use. We're sort of unique as archaeologists. My answer is because life happens on intimate scales. We might be more apt to notice how large, spectacular, uncommon materials shape us, like how your behavior changes when you enter a Gothic cathedral or an amusement park. But, you know, it's precisely the way that objects sort of fade into the background that makes them powerful players in the construction of our identities and our societies. It acts along with us in the very constitution of society. And there's a sociologist I really love, Irving Goffman, who had a paradigm called frame analysis, saying, you know, it's a metaphor. He says, you know, unless the frame on a picture, an actual picture, is ornate, we're not meant to notice it. It's about the art, right? You see the art. And we don't always think about, say, you know, the plain white plates in front of us on the dinner table. We think about food and family and the experiences of the meal. We think about culture. But these everyday goods like dishes and medicines introduce us to life at the household scale, which is a wonderful counter to homogenizing narratives that have largely focused on the lives of white people,
right,
and in Appalachian studies on men and on minors. And we can instead look at women and children and LGBTQ plus folks, people of color, who have, of course, always been in Appalachia, but have not factored equitably in representation and therefore, you know, policy and treatment of people in region.
In thinking about some of the digs that you've done and some of the mm-hmm. things that you've done, what's one of the most powerful stories? What's a really amazing takeaway that has really changed or impacted the way you think about your research?
Yeah, first and foremost, Appalachia is diverse and always has been. I encounter a lot of narratives about architecture, that the built world in coal towns is homogenous. And by the way, it sometimes is, and it sometimes isn't. Sometimes we see a lot of architectural variability, like in Jenkins. But, you know, like historian Randy Shiflett says, homogenous houses don't mean homogenous life. Women, for example, are integral to company town life. And I hear a lot of really interesting public perceptions, like all women in coal towns are prostitutes, all women in coal towns are boarding house matrons or domestic workers. Most coal towns in Kentucky were family populated, even in seasonal camps. And how are we going to know about Appalachia if we only study half the population? So we can look at the household to look at women's experiences beyond even the domestic sphere. And I would say my biggest takeaway is that, you know, contrary to deficiency narratives, Appalachia isn't backwards. And this has been encoded in our discursive construction of the region. We've always framed Appalachia as a region of need, from local color writing in the 19th century to how the Appalachian Regional Commission talks about Appalachia today. But material goods across sites at Appalachia prove that Appalachians were never isolated from the market. The flip side of that is you hear these glut narratives that Appalachia didn't, you know, failed the industrial transition because of its retarded culture, that we couldn't cope with industrialization or the post-industrial transition, sort of a trash in, trash out narrative. I mean, I study trash for a living. Trust me, Appalachia is no trashier than any other rural place in America. We lack infrastructure and we've been exploited by industry, frankly. And so many material critiques of Appalachia paint us as being victims or poster children for fast, you know, either an archaic way of life or fast capitalism, like Diane Sawyer's 2020 Children of the Mountains. You know, they're like, what's going to tug at people's heartstrings more than Mountain Dew sitting in a baby's stroller, cup holder? But, you know, the logic of capitalism dictates that its true costs are paid by laborers and their environments. And that's what's happened here. And we have to be really critically aware of how materials factor into this construction of the region as other.
Your research is some of my favorite. It is very impactful. And, you know, I am thrilled to be working with you on future projects.
Same.
Zeta Kimura is an interdisciplinary and social science professor at the University of Kentucky's Lewis Honors College.
Coming up after the break.
In the day and age that we're in, when the truth can be made to seem a lie, and a lie can be made to seem the truth, I wanted to remind everyone that truth is a real thing.
60 Minutes correspondent Scott Pelley on his new memoir and his visit to the Kentucky Book Fair in just a few weeks. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
A Publisher's Weekly review of the new memoir by Scott Pelley begins with, "A TV newsman confronts war, terror, economic collapse, and presidential deceit in this tumultuous memoir." Pelley, a 60 Minutes correspondent and former anchor of CBS Evening News, combines firsthand observations, interviews with newsmakers, and reported profiles to recapture the stories he covered. Well, if you're going to be at the Kentucky Book Fair at the Kentucky Horse Park near Lexington on November 16th, you can hear from Scott Pelley himself. He is the keynote speaker. And he joins us now with a little preview of what you will experience. Greetings, Scott.
Tom, great to be with you on Eastern Standard. Thank you.
You bet. And, you know, it amazes me that you managed to write this memoir even as you were anchoring the evening news and doing 60 Minutes. How in the world did you manage it?
Well, you know how it is, Tom, for us reporters. I spent a lot of time on airplanes during that period of time. And airplanes are a great place to write. Nobody bothers you, and they bring you as much coffee as you can drink. And so I spent a lot of time on planes working on this.
You begin by telling the reader that the book is about your search for meaning. Tell us about that.
You know, Tom, when I wanted to write this book, I realized that there wasn't a great appetite in the market for a memoir about Scott Pelley. That wasn't what I wanted to write about. I wanted to write a memoir that wasn't about me. So it occurred to me that I had met some of the most inspiring and interesting people around the world who had discovered the meaning of their lives during some of the great historic moments of our time. And so each of the chapters are named after values and virtues, things like courage and selflessness and gallantry. And there's stories about these people who showed those great values that we all cherish during the most difficult moments.
One chapter is titled Objectivity, Learning from Unpleasant Truth. And objectivity among journalists is frequently challenged these days. What are your thoughts on objectivity?
Well, you know, objectivity is a real thing, and it's what we in journalism try to practice, to look at all sides of a story, to research the facts and make sure that we understand the facts before we report to the public. Unfortunately, Tom, as you know, and this is implied in your question, there are a lot of places in the media these days, on television and very much so on the internet, where information is spun in a direction that their audience wants to hear it. We're now in this era where we have channels of information that are simply channels of confirming information. They tell us that everything we already believe is correct. Well, of course, we all know that that can't be true. And no democracy has ever survived that way. We are a people from hundreds of different places, hundreds of different walks of life, and you have to turn to objective media, media that sometimes challenges what you think, in order to move our country not left, not right, but forward.
That Publisher's Weekly review of your book that I mentioned closes with this statement, which I think is a follow-up to what you were just saying, and it is, Pelley's narratives are a riveting blend of investigative reporting, color commentary, and personal reminiscence. They make a convincing case for why journalism still matters. Tell us why, in these times in particular, it still matters.
You know, Tom, there is no democracy without journalism. The folks at home all across the country have to have generally reliable information in order to make decisions about their own lives, the lives of their family, and the life of the country. And so that's where journalism comes in, particularly now in this new age that we're living in. You know, never before in human history has more information been available to more people. Well, that's terrific. But it's also true that never before in human history has more bad information been available to more people. You know, and by that, I mean these hostile nation states with these websites that pose to be from the United States trying to influence our elections, and corrupt politicians and their agents who are trying to lie to the American people about what's going on in the world. And so that's precisely where journalism comes in, and it is why I say there is no democracy without journalism.
How did you arrive at the title of your book, Truth Worth Telling?
You know, I went through a lot of titles. I finally decided that in the day and age that we're in, when the truth can be made to seem a lie, and a lie can be made to seem the truth, I wanted to remind everyone that truth is a real thing. It is a verifiable thing. It is not a matter of opinion. If I give you $5 and ask you for change of $100, you're not going to believe me if I told you I gave you a $100 bill. That's what I mean. There is empirical truth in this world. And so that's where the title of the book comes from. And I explain throughout the book, these people who have had the principles that we all believe in, and to remind everyone that values matter and character is destiny.
Scott, when I picked up your book for the first time, I flipped to the center and those wonderful photographs, which themselves tell quite a story. And you are pictured with frightened refugee children with Presidents Bush, Obama, Trump, in war zones alongside fighters, with Hugh Jackman putting you through his workout routine in preparation for the movie Wolverine, and a whole lot more. It's a lot to pack into a career. Is this memoir to be continued?
Oh, I hope so. I've already started writing or at least organizing my thoughts for a second book. I've been at 60 Minutes 21 years now, Tom. I had to stop and think. We're in our 52nd season at 60 Minutes. Incredible. And I intend to keep working at 60 Minutes for the next many years, and I hope continuing to gather those stories that tell the stories of people who are the most remarkable people in the world for the 60 Minutes broadcast and maybe for the next book as well.
60 Minutes correspondent Scott Pelley, author of the memoir Truth Worth Telling. Thank you so much, Scott.
Tom, great to be with you on Eastern Standard. Thank you.
Also speaking on November 16th at the Kentucky Book Fair, CNN's Jim Acosta, author of The Enemy of the People, A Dangerous Time to Tell the Truth in America. We'll have Tom Eblen's interview with Acosta next week on Eastern Standard. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app, on esweku.com, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.